Welcome, everyone. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel with Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast.
Good morning, Amy. You're looking
Good morning, Greg.
Nice today.
Thank you.
Fresh and like full of energy. I'm glad to see that.
We'll see how it goes.
Maybe the outside looks better than the inside feels, but it's all right.
Well, I always get energy when I do this show because I love this. So, All right. Let's start with a question from Joseph Arnold. How do I respond to this relativist? And then he quotes him. No one I know who explains anything with a relativist explanation thinks relativism is a universal absolute principle. This is a straw man.
Well, there's I'm trying to think exactly how best to respond to this because of the words. No one thinks. Well, that's actually not true if what they if what that person means is no one thinks they think that relativism is a universal explanation of morality. And I know that's false because the very eminent philosopher Michael Ruse, who is an atheistic philosopher and evolutionist, makes it crystal clear that morals are relative and that we are tricked into believing in objective morality because it serves an evolutionary purpose. But there is no basis for it, is what he says. That is, there is no external moral code that informs our internal sense of morality. That is completely a result of Darwinian evolution. Now, this is a very thoughtful, very well-educated PhD in philosophy who has written books on the issue. It is clear that he is completely convinced in his own mind, insofar as he discusses the issue that the and educates on it that there, as he puts it, there is no basis for objective morality. There is no external moral set of obligations or set of moral obligations. Now, I just cite him because he's a well-known philosopher who writes on this issue. And that is one counterexample to the point that's being made. And so in the discipline, which is what I represent, I don't represent every individual person's view. I represent the official view. And Michael
Ruse.
Thank you. Senior moment. Michael Ruse represents that view. So it's not a straw man. Now, that does not mean that my characterization applies in every single case of every single human being. And what's curious about Michael Ruse's assessment is he says, now, we don't think morals are relative, or at least much of the time. And that isn't to say there aren't relativists. He's speaking to those who are objectivists. And he said the reason you're objectivists and objectivists is because evolution has tricked you not just to believe in morality, but to believe that the morality is objective or else it wouldn't work for the evolutionary purpose. Now, it's so odd, isn't it? Because on the one hand, and he doesn't believe this, but I'm just talking about the way the language is. It sounds like evolution's working hard to accomplish a certain goal for its purposes. And everybody acknowledges, even Michael Ruse in lucid moments would say, no, there's no goal here at all for evolution. It's not teleological. There are no ends in view in evolution. But this is the way it's worked out for the sake of survival. And it would not have served evolution's purpose of survival if the belief that we had about evolution was that evolution was relative, but it was a kind of a useful fiction. No, we have to believe it's objective, or many do, or else we wouldn't follow it. And then we conjure up our explanations for the objective reality, which is God, and that makes it more forceful because now we're under God and he's looking over our shoulder, so we better do what's right or he's going to get us. And so, anyway, that's the explanation. I think it's riddled with difficulties. For one, I don't know. It's not clear to me that any configuration of atoms in my body can cause me to believe something, to hold a belief, because that's a mental activity, which is a soulish activity, which feels like it's a free activity. We believe things for reasons. And so consequently, and not because our chemistry causes it, but that would have to be the case if that characterization were true. Okay. So first, this isn't a straw man. And there are lots of people who hold this view. Michael Shermer holds this view, another professional broadly in the field. He's a sociologist, I think his PhD is. But nevertheless, I'm not misrepresenting anybody here. When you talk to people, in the engagement at the moment, they are convinced that morality is just a matter of individual opinion. It's subjective morality. It depends on the subject, which is why people say, well, that's your truth, but it's not my truth. Who are you for pushing your morality on me? Notice how all of these terms suggest that morality is an individual affair. It is not dictated by something outside of us. It is dictated by something inside of us. And by the way, that's the kind of classic distinction. It is mind-dependent. That is our mind-dependent, or maybe the mind, collective mind of the society if you're thinking about social contract or something like that. It is not a feature of the objective world. Morality isn't. Okay, so to the charge of straw man, false. I'm not guilty of that. Second, there is a point here, though, and my conviction is that everybody is actually, when push comes to shove, a common sense realist when it comes to morality. And when I say common sense realist, I mean realist in the sense that they acknowledge objective morality is out there, not in here, and object dependent, not subject dependent, and common sense, meaning they have a faculty to assess this. And most things that are right and wrong are pretty obvious to us, even though there may be cultural differences and variations. At the core, we have something solid. In fact, I just finished C.S. Lewis's the opening section of Mere Christianity, which everybody ought to read every year, in my view, every Christian. It's just magnificent. Where he argues for this fact that we are all aware of and we talk about morality as if it's objective. Now, of course, you can go to Michael Ruse's point. Well, of course we talk about it that way because we are tricked to believe it's objective. But I don't think it's a trick. I have no reason to believe that I've been tricked by my biology. And like I said, this is riddled with difficulties. And so I think we have a common sense objective morality because there is such a thing. Okay. Now, what this means is human beings have a foot in both camps. That is, human beings who are not objectivists. On the one hand, they talk like relativists when it's convenient. And then when they're not guarding turf, then the objectivist convictions they have about morality come out all the time. You know, hey, you shouldn't be cutting in line in front of me. You know, they'll be talking to you about subjective morality and how morality is just a matter of personal opinion. Then they say, hey, you shouldn't be cutting in line. That ain't right. Get to the back of the line. What do you mean that ain't right? I thought you were a relativist, you know. Notice how even in the same sentence, in fact, Lewis says this so elegantly in his book. He says something like you find a person that is advancing subjective morality, denying the moral law, and he's going to take it back immediately before you can say Jack Robinson, right, in the same sentence. Now, why does this happen? It's because they have convictions that are convenient about moral relativism, but it turns out they are human. They are, in fact, human beings made in the image of God who live in God's world. And some might recall, and you may too, because you read the chapter so assiduously, editing for me in the second edition of Tactics, the chapter on Inside Out, that there are things that are built inside that can't keep from coming outside because they're part of our nature and God put them there. And that's an example of that. So on the one hand, I understand the field and I understand what educated people assessing this thing mean when they say no objective morality, only subjective morality. And Michael Ruse and Michael Shermer and a whole host of others make this quite clear. I'm not guilty of a straw man characterization here. However, I have always acknowledged that we are all actually common sense realists deep down inside because we're made in the image of God. And that is going to come out very, very quickly in any conversation about morality. All you have to do is listen. And that's the Inside Out tactic.
So in this situation, when he's talking to someone and they say that relativism is not a universal moral principle, how would you then turn that to your advantage? Because it seems to me like they're admitting there is some sort of objective morality. And so then you can't you just challenge them on that? And
well, wait, if they say that there is no objective moral principle, they are declaring a truth, but not a moral truth. So they are objectivists with regards to truth. They're not total like postmodernist types. However, they are not claiming a moral truth. So they are right, that is correct, they think, in holding to subjective morality. So this is not, strictly speaking, a suicide circumstance, a formal suicide situation. But it turns out to be practical suicide in conversation if we just wait long enough and listen to them. Because in practical terms, they start talking as if there's nothing self-contradictory about a relativistic view, in my understanding. But in practice, people will speak relativistically as if that's the truth, and then will start uttering objectivist moral statements, like I was just referring to. And so the approach then for the Christian is just to keep listening. Mm-hmm. And if somebody were to make this case to me, I might try to pursue it this way, and as you'll be able to see in a moment with a short little dialogue, I'm trying to head them off at the pass and ambush them a little bit. I said, okay, so you don't believe there's a name? Okay, I got it. By the way, but are you an atheist? Yeah, of course I'm an atheist. Well, and have you ever objected to the existence of God based on the problem of evil? I'm just curious about that. Of course they do. That's a huge problem. That's one of the reasons I don't think there's a God. Okay, now tell me what you mean by the problem of evil as a relativist. That's the ambush, okay? Because the objection to the existence of God based on the problem of evil can only be sustained if the evil is real. And that is, it's an actual violation of an objective moral obligation. But if there are no objective moral obligations, then there can't be any violations. Therefore, there can't be any real evil. All there is stuff we don't like. But then our objection on evil to God is more like, well, I can't believe in a God because of, you know, Brussels sprouts or broccoli or asparagus or something else, that liver that is disgusting to somebody's palate, kind of thing. But that's a trivial objection. So the objection to God's existence based on the existence of evil in the world, notice how people put it, is a tacit admission that morality is objective. And without objective morality, there is no problem of evil in the world to object to. So there's an example of them kind of, on the one hand, claiming to be a relativist, but then showing their hand with this intuitively understandable objection against God's existence based on the existence of real evil in the world. And they're right about that, by the way.
Well, that leads us right into the next question from Carlos M. Other than skeptical theism, what other approaches can a Christian undertake to answer the problem of gratuitous evil?
Okay, so here's another this is another question that deals broadly with the realm of morality. I'll have you define, because I know you looked up kind of a formal definition of skeptical theism, and that would be better than me trying to explain it for the moment. But I just want to make the observation that the concern that I have just raised with regards to the last question about the problem of evil requiring an external objective standard being violated. And then for those familiar with the fairly straightforward moral argument for the existence of God, moral laws require a moral lawgiver. So if there is any kind of evil, even gratuitous evil, which is more evil than one would expect is necessary to accomplish some greater good. So a lot of times people, Christians, will argue, well, God allows this evil because there's a greater good that he has in mind. And the complaint is, well, wait a minute, there's a lot of evil that doesn't accomplish any greater good. So that's not going to work with what's called gratuitous evil. So the person who raises the problem of gratuitous evil is still stuck with the problem of making sense of the concept of evil itself from within their materialistic worldview. Okay? There's a little end around, and they might say, well, I don't believe in right and wrong or gratuitous evil or any kind of evil because I'm a relativist because I'm an atheist. So they're trying to be consistent. But you believe in evil, and so within your system, it seems to me that there is a problem, even though the deductive problem won't work, you know. It's possible there could be a God and evil if he has a morally sufficient reason for it. That's the deductive problem. The inductive problem is going to get you, and that is there seems to be too much evil to have a good reason for, which is the gratuitous evil argument. Okay, so there still is this big problem, the big hurdle for them. And by the way, even if they take the second choice, it's your problem, not mine. It's in your system. I don't believe in any of this stuff. I think that's baloney. Because I have virtually never had somebody object to evil in the world on any grounds and was carefully making the point that they are not assuming there's evil. All they are doing is just looking internally at our system and saying there's an internal contradiction. We can't make sense of this contradiction. That just doesn't happen. And once again, it's because they're human beings made in the image of God. You know, so anyway, so then the question is, what about skeptical theism as an answer and anything else they could say about gratuitous evil? So go ahead and explain what a skeptical theism is.
Yeah, so I just looked up a really brief one-sentence view of what it is, and it says, skeptical theism is the view that God exists, but that we should be skeptical of our ability to discern God's reasons for acting or refraining from acting in any particular instance.
Okay. So I actually think this is a wonderful principle. I don't like the idea it's called skeptical theism because it sounds like you're skeptical of theism when what you really is agnostic about God's intentions. You know, what I don't know what skepticism has to do with this issue. So it sounds like some outsider named this thing. So
it looks like it's specifically used in terms of the problem of evil. So being skeptical that you can know why evil is happening.
Well, that's, I think the principle, as you've just described it, and tell us where you got that from.
Oh, gosh, it was at some university website. There's a few different ones people can look up.
But it's some credible philosophical source book, I think, is what you said to me earlier. So, I mean, this seems like a credible way of defining it. I think that I don't care for the words that much, but I'll just take it at face value. I don't see any reason why this is not a perfectly acceptable point of view. I have said many times here on this show and other shows, Amy, when people ask what, why questions about God, why did God do this? Why did God do that? I said most of those are really unanswerable. And the reason they're unanswerable is because we don't know the mind of God on it. Just like we don't know the mind of each other on most things they do unless they communicate them to us, and a lot of times they don't. So, you know, this is a normal part of our experience dealing with persons, all right? And so especially when it comes to God, who is like not exactly like us. He's similar enough in some ways and maybe just analogously, as some would say, that we get a general picture, but he's so far out there And he's so other in so many other ways that you know, there's all kinds of blind spots. To acknowledge the blind spots in our understanding about God is completely legitimate and completely reasonable and completely rational. And in fact, with regards to the question of gratuitous evil, you can think about everybody listening who is a Christian can think about and is aware of times in the past where things happened in their life that God allowed and they said, what's up with that? What possible good could come from that? But then in hindsight, maybe sometimes years down the line, we see, oh man, that's what was going on. I see the fruit of it. Now, William Lane Craig says sometimes the fruit of something bad happening doesn't happen for centuries. So we're not going to have access to this in our life. Famously, Corrie Ten Boom, in her book, The Hiding Place, talks about the flea problem in the concentration camp that they had. It was terrible. But it turned out because there were so many fleas infesting the particular area that she was at with the other women that were there in that German concentration camp, Mauthausen or Dachau or something like that. I can't remember exactly where she was at. She said it kept the guards away. The guards didn't want to go in there because they didn't want to get the fleas. So they left them alone, which means they had a lot of privacy to pursue spiritual things that they wouldn't have been able to pursue otherwise. And this she realized afterwards. So I don't see any reason why we can't fall back on what is termed here skeptical theism as a legitimate explanation. And not only that, I mean, and I think of it, you asked, is there some other thing we can say than just that? And I don't, I mean, maybe you have something else, but I don't see the least bit of trouble with that as an answer to the problem of so-called gratuitous evil. Frankly, if a person says, well, I don't see the liability, I don't see the reason, the better good that can come out of this poor deer dying in the forest or something like that, you know, well, maybe there's not good coming out of the deer dying viciously in the forest or whatever through a, you know, fire or something. And that's usually the illustration that people bring up. But there is a certain system that is placed, put in place that is good system that has as certain consequences to the system these kinds of things. And so it's kind of an all or nothing thing. You get the program, which is a better program overall, okay, even though there are instances as a result of that program where, you know, we can't say, well, there's good coming out of this, you know, fried Bambi, you know, who's going to say that? But it's the broader picture, and maybe that's a little bit of an alternative. I talk about this in The Story of Reality, and I got this kind of perspective from philosopher Greg Gansel, so I thank him for it. I did a footnote to him too. But he said, look, if there's an elephant in the room, you're going to know it. Okay? But if there's a flea in the room, you may not know it. If there's one flea in the room, okay? And so there are certain circumstances that lend themselves to us knowing about them really easily. But there are other circumstances that may be true, but we can't figure them out really quickly. And this evil question, you know, the reason God has for allowing this evil is like a flea type thing. You know, we may not be able to discern it. Now, who is in the best position to know whether it's a good, works out ultimately for good in the long run, the whole system? Well, not us, because we don't have that perspective. God is the only one. And if you're going to deny that God has a sufficient reason for doing this, if you say, no, he doesn't, well, then the burden of proof is on the individual making the claim that God can't have a good reason. It's not on the Christian to give the reason for any incident of what appears to be gratuitous evil.
I think that's helpful. I mean, we can't know what's gratuitous. I don't know how we could ever know that. But one other thing we can do, and I think in terms of justifying our understanding of reality, I think it's helpful. I don't know that an atheist would follow this line of argumentation, but certainly Christians, what's helpful, I think, for us is to look at the cross, because God has proved a lot of things about himself on the cross. He's proved that he has the power to raise someone from the dead. He proves that he loves us enough to send his son to die for us. Mm-hmm. Jesus proved his love for us on the cross. If Jesus was willing to go to the cross and take on our sins, then obviously he cares about us. So that proves that. It shows God's all-knowing, because he brought the cross, the whole situation from, you know, the beginning of time until Jesus. He worked everything out so that this would happen at this time in this way. It shows his sovereignty. It shows his wisdom. It shows his justice, his hatred for evil. It shows all of these things. And when we look at that, we can say, all right, well, that's proof. We see who God is. We see what he loves. We see what he hates. We see what he's capable of. And so when we come to something that we don't understand, that seems gratuitous, then we can hang on to the things that we see very clearly, mm-hmm. and say, okay, well, I know God's all-loving. I know he's all-powerful. I know he's all-knowing. I know he's wise and just and all these things. Therefore, if I can't see the answer to this other question, I can trust that he can. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a helpful way to go.
Yeah, I agree. Just going over Psalm 13, which is a favorite psalm of mine. It's short and it's bleak. It actually starts out bleak, and this is the "How long, O Lord?" Psalms. You know, it's like, "How long, O Lord, will you reject me forever?" I'm looking for it right now. Yeah, "Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long will I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart all the day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me?" So this is gratuitous evil. You know, look at, you're not there, and I didn't do anything wrong. My enemy's knocking me around. Okay. But then he goes on to say that, you know, it ends on a bright note. "But I have trusted in your loving kindness. My heart will rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me." So he looks at the things that God has done and does do that display his goodness, and that is what helps cover him for the times that he is unclear about. Mm-hmm. When the circumstances themselves are not clear evidence of God's goodness.
And as you mentioned, we can look back in our own lives, and not just in the cross, but certainly in our own lives too, see situations where that worked out. And so I think the longer we're with the Lord, the easier it, well, the more we have to deal with things like this, the more we have to look back on and stand on, and it, trusting gets better when you can see a past record in your own life and in other people's lives, which is why I love reading stories about Christians from times past who had way more difficult lives than I did.
One last quick biblical illustration. Saturday between Good Friday and Resurrection Sunday. What is going through the minds of all those of the disciples, all of them, not just the 11 left and the 70 and the, you know, the 120. There are a lot of disciples that Jesus had. What's going through their mind when all that they hoped for good for the kingdom at their doorstep, the hopes are smashed because now their leader is dead. Now what? Okay. So that's gratuitous evil. This is a total wrong, and nothing good has come of it until Sunday, until the resurrection. And then you see this all ties together. As Jesus explains on the road to Emmaus, here's why it all had to happen, and here is the consequence. Here is the result, salvation.
Thank you, Greg. Well, we gave our listeners a 10-minute bonus today.
Oh, okay. Well, it's good stuff, you know.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone, for your questions on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk, and thanks for listening. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.